So we're going to look at the same handout, the eschatological glossary, and we're going to work our way to the end. One of the reasons that I began this series on eschatology at all was we were working our way to the end of the Westminster Confession of Faith, and the last couple chapters are on eschatology, on end times, last things. But they don't even address most of the issues that people want to talk about in modern discussions around eschatology, because it's a 17th century document. And that was before the great madness of the modern church in eschatology. In other words, it just doesn't touch down on a lot of things that people are thinking about, particularly millennial theory and the Great Tribulation and the Rapture, and those things aren't even mentioned, right? So a lot of people are saying, well, what about that stuff? And that's the impetus for beginning the eschatology series. So I wanted to make sure we got through these definitions. Those are particular topics that people are interested in, and you should at least know your way around and have some sense of what the words mean. So I wanted to grab this last side, this last half of the glossary we're working on there, and put a little definition, a little further definition, based upon some questions I had from you last week on the millennial question. Make sure you have those particular words down and know what they mean. Can somebody tell me what premillennial simply means?
Before the 1,000 years.
Yeah, sure. Before the millennium. And postmillennial means after the millennium, which is to say Jesus comes bodily before the millennium, before the 1,000-year reign described in Revelation 20, or after it, right? Bodily return after it. Now, as I taught that a couple weeks ago, I taught it in just those terms and said all millennials is a variety of postmillennials. And the reason I say that is this, because in a premillennial system, you have a different shape of history. History, as it develops, is shaped differently than it is in a postmillennial or amillennial understanding, which is to say we're in a certain age right now, and Jesus will physically return before a whole other section of human history for 1,000 years called the millennium, where both, on the other hand, both the post and amillennialists say, no, we're in this thing right now. And it may get better, and there may be some fulfillment of promises, like a post-millennial understanding. Or maybe evil and good are going to just duke it out until the very end when Christ comes. But when he comes, history as we know it is over. He's not going to usher in another 1,000 years, something of kind of human history and salvation and the making of babies and all that before then he ushers in the end. So both all millennials and postmillennial theory have us in this kingdom age, if we want to call it that, the age we're in. And when Christ comes, the jig's up. He's going to raise the dead. It's not going to be another similar part of human history before the end. It's the end. Where premillennials and sticks in has the 1,000 years that really is a different kind of human history. We have resurrected saints running around on earth and various things like that. It's not going to be like it is now. Okay, so there's a different shape to history. Now that's important because as we're looking forward, trying to understand what God has planned, right, trying to read the prophecies of the Bible and say, okay, what's God got going? We see regularly that when Jesus comes, it's over. He's not ushering in, there's not 1,007 years or something like that. All that is something that has kind of come into the church, except, you know, especially thinking of like the tribulation issues here, the Great Tribulation and the Rapture and all this kind of stuff we're going to look at next, that really comes into the church in the last 100 years, 150 years, as far as the seed of these kinds of thoughts. Premillennialism goes all the way back to the early church and understanding the reign of Christ on earth for 1,000 years. So that goes all the way back. And I think really to some degree all millennial, postmillennial theory goes back in various forms too, but doesn't come to real rigid definitions until we get to the 19th century, when people are starting to distinguish between these different schools of thought, and then the development of dispensational premillennialism that pushes the envelope entirely and really takes over as far as American evangelical thinking goes. So there's a distinction between a premillennial theory of history, structure of history, and a postmillennial structure of history, and that's important. Those are distinguishable quite obviously on that basis. Any question on that? That's just something to add on to the things we had said before. Okay. So then let me make a further distinction before we move out of the millennial thing into the rapture and tribulation. Oh, yeah. Sure.
So are there postmillennialists that believe in a literal 1,000 years?
Yes. So under the postmillennial deal there, I got postmills range from chilistic, or those who believe in a literal thousand years, right, the thousand-year golden age. There are those kind of post-mills, and there's also those who just kind of assume optimism and assume blessings are going to come, but don't have it wrapped into a thousand-year framework. So post-millennialism has a range and includes that actual thousand-year notion. Correct.
So how popular is the other
thing? I've never met one. I've read a couple, and it seems like in the 19th century you get a little more of that. You get less and less of it in the 20th century as far as postmodernism that I've read. You know, there's plenty out there that I've not read. But that's my kind of sense of it as I deal with these different positions. And just to hand it to you right now, so re-studying this here for the last few months has probably made me more sympathetic and open to all the views besides dispensationalism that are on the table. I see more and understand better where they're coming from and can see it better and can be sympathetic with their understanding. Anyway, so the studying has been a good opening experience for me, which is good, and it ought to be that way. And then closing on other things too, you know, but the whole process. One distinction between an all-millennialist and a post-millennialist. This is important. There's some question about that. How do you distinguish? Because they're so similar in a lot of ways, the way the shape of history and so on. The post-millennialist has what Ed was just putting his finger on. Either sometimes in their minds there is a literal thousand years that's going to happen. It's going to be the golden age, and that's going to be, and Christ will return after that thousand years. And they take the thousand years from Revelation 20, but not a very good reading, I'm afraid, of Revelation 20. And that's the problem. They read it strangely. And find a thousand years that is going to be a golden age, as opposed to looking at that passage as I tried to present it over the course of a couple of weeks there, that this is the time from the advent of Christ to the return of Christ and the kingdom age we're in. But then on my side, I'm not looking for a thousand years of golden age. I'm just thinking that God's going to bring all sorts of untold blessings in this age, right? In this long expanse of time between the resurrection of Christ, the coming of Christ, and then the return of Christ. And I think if you rub your eyes and poke your head up in history, you'll notice that, like immediately, right? We like exist in our time of opulence and everything else, and we just think this is normal. But the more one studies history, the more one's shocked to find how little peace we find on earth, generally. But that's part of the gospel, is to spread peace on earth, right? That's part of what we're doing as Christians, is ending war. Not making it, ending war. Increasing production, bringing our gifts to, and anyway, that's my expectation as a post-millennialist. I don't expect 1,000 years. Maybe it's 10,000 years. Maybe it's 20,000 years till Christ returns. I don't know. We always seem to think it's like going to be next second, you know, tomorrow sometime Jesus is coming. Maybe he is. But what if not? What if we're still in the early church? What if this is the early church and 10,000 years from now they look back and they can't remember, you know, R.C. Sproul from Augustine. Who came first? I can't remember. They're all early church guys, right? Just like you don't know if Tertullian or Irenaeus came first. They're just early church names, right? What if that's the case? There's a postmillennial thought for you just to think about what could the church do by the Spirit of God over the course of the next 10,000 years as we grow in faithfulness, as we grow in maturity over the generations, which we certainly have over the last 20 centuries. So anyway, we're very provincial in our thinking most of the time in our perceptions, and hopefully a postmillennial eschatology will get you out of that. So the distinction then between a real optimism with regard to the work of the kingdom on earth and Christians and Christian industry and what God gives us his Spirit to do, on the one hand, the postmillennialist is going to expect a lot. The amillennialist is saying, hey, maybe don't expect too much. Don't get your hopes up too high. That's kind of a little more of an amillennial, you know, reservation saying, oh, Satan's very powerful. Indeed he is, and that's a good recollection. Satan and all his forces are still very powerful, even if he is locked in the abyss and with a chain and bound so that he can't deceive the nations. And here we are, the nation's coming, right? But he's coming back again, so don't get overly triumphalistic, you postmillennialists, say the all-mills. And that's useful. That's a helpful, you know, gut check to remember, yeah, we gotta be not on our own, because listen, here I'll give you an example. And then we'll be done with this. And then move on to the next thing. The postmillennialism, by the time of like World War I, early 20th century, had become just sheer liberalism. The advancement of men were getting better and better. They thought that they had done away with war. I mean, honestly, after the Napoleonic invasions and so on, and getting in toward World War I, like, hey, we've advanced as humanity past war, and it's just this, like, godless, Christless optimism. And that's what became, in most people's minds, especially premillennialists, that's what postmillennialism is. It's unbelieving, worldly optimism. And World War I just went ahead and put a bullet through the head of that. Right? World War I was terrible. And postmillennialism was shot, but that's not a faithful postmillennialism. That's a humanistic optimism that's cloaked in Christian garb. Right? A faithful postmillennialism understands sin, understands the reality of Satan, understands the world, the flesh, and the devil, but that Christ, by the power of the gospel and his spirit working in his people, is going to overcome all of that and produce fruit that will blow the minds of everyone looking at it, saying it started there and it got there. The kingdom of God on earth, right? The people of God working. So there's an optimism and production built into postmillennialism that there simply often isn't with a lot of all millennial thoughts. That's a distinction maybe to help you say, okay, well, you know, what are these distinctions between all and postmillennialism and between premillennial thought and the rest of eschatological thought? So I've mentioned those things that may tease you into looking for more. Any questions just on those? Oakley, yeah.
I think in the wheat and the tares story, can't think of the word, but are they distinguishable at the end before the harvester comes? Is that part of that story?
I don't think so in the story. Let's we can check it. It's right there in Matthew 13. We're going to be going there this morning as well.
I mean, when he returns, he finds both, right?
You bet.
He doesn't find, like, field of wheat with a few tares in it. So, I mean, there's some check there, too.
Sure. There's check there, and there's check in Revelation 20, if we're reading that, right, where Satan's loosed and the nations turn violent against Christ and against the people. So there's that, too. So those are kind of checks on how we're thinking of the flowering of the blessings and production in postmillennial thought. Yeah, Kim. Yes.
What do you think Peter means when he's talking about hastening the day of the Lord?
Good. So the question is, what does Peter mean when he talks about hastening the day of the Lord? My sense of that, just kind of from the hip here on that one, is that as Christians are obedient and growing in grace, that's the plan for the people of God, is to grow and to grow in maturity. And as we live faithfully, I think we're moving toward the return of the Lord. We're moving toward that. I think that's the sense of it. But again, I'm just shooting from the hip. I can look at it more carefully and get a better answer to you later, maybe. Yeah, Bill.
You mentioned something about the time. I don't remember what it was, but Deuteronomy 7:9 talks about, you know, keep his covenant and steadfast love with those who love him. Keep his commandments to 1,000 generations. That's like the kind of a long time, I think.
Yeah. It also might be a symbolic number.
Which he defines.
I say that for all you pre-mills out there. Yeah. Anyway. You bet. So yeah, there's a long view in that God has for covenant families, for the people. Right? You say 3 or 4 generations of curse, whoa, that's overwhelming, and it is. But how about 1,000 generations of blessing? And that always, that seems, as I study it, where sin abounds, and it does abound, and it is real, and it does hurt, and it does destroy, grace abounds all the more. It super abounds, right? God outdoes what Satan's done. And that's an important element, I think, in our eschatological thought. Okay, seeing no more questions, let's look down at this last section, then tribulation and rapture. The Great Tribulation is our first topic here, based upon Revelation 2:7. Chapters 2 and 7, and then Matthew 24, the Olivet Discourse. The Great Tribulation is seen as a time of divine judgment, full of tremendous affliction, calamity, and mourning, just prior to the return of Jesus, or Jesus' parousia. Okay, so this is, again, we see it in the book of Revelation very clearly. If we're going to look at later on this morning, Revelation 7, where there's a countless number of saints in white robes. They're standing before the throne and praising God. And the angel says, hey, where are these guys? And John says, well, you know. And he says, yes, these are the ones coming out of the Great Tribulation. These are the saints that have been faithful to the end. And here they are in a countless number before the thrones and praising God. So they're coming out of that tribulation into their heavenly reign. They're praising God or whatever's going on there. Their intermediate state, we might call it, before the resurrection. They're in heaven. They're represented in white robes. So this tribulation is going to happen just prior to the return, the bodily return of Jesus. Okay. Now, again, if you flip the page over, you remember the kind of general orientation terms here of futurism, historicism, preterism, and so on. A futurist is going to understand the Great Tribulation as a future event. Right? There's bad stuff coming. There's great judgment. The day of the Lord coming. And as soon as that's done, Jesus will return. Okay, that's the idea of the futurist. The preterist sees that same thing going on, but sees in the first century. Right? The Great Tribulation occurred when Jerusalem was sacked and razed and destroyed. That was the tribulation of those days, and Jesus is going to come after that. Now, come immediately, and there you have this kind of possible full preterism of saying everything's fulfilled, Jesus came in the first century, there's nothing left. But that's not what we're talking about. anyway, having gone through that text, you can go back and think about it, but the preterist is going to see the tribulation is already having occurred, and therefore the rapture being post-tribulational, right? Far post-tribulational. Far away from that. Yeah, Ed?
So, I forget, you hold to an early date of the writing of Revelation?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
But you would have that year.
Right. Yeah.
You have a later date.
Letter John's is kind of talking about it after the fact. That's the same kind of deal with the book of Daniel, right? Where a lot of scholars say, oh, this is just like written after the fact to like make it look like Daniel really knew what he was talking about. Yeah, it's the same kind of thing there. Although you clearly get the early date of the Gospels, right? They're before AD 70. My contention is that all of the New Testament books are written before AD 70 because none of them have the marks of saying, did you see what happened? Which is exactly what they do. They open with that, right? Any book after it. That's such an important event. Yeah?
You could also say that there have been martyrs throughout the history of the church.
Absolutely.
So that we are in a tribulation. If this for some people, they're literally
absolutely, absolutely. So that's a good point. That there we might talk about the Great Tribulation as this day of the Lord against apostate Israel in the first century. But there are things like that that run through church history. Right? There's tribulation that all Christians are going to push through, and some of them get a lot more than others. And God is treating the saints, I think, the same way. Welcoming the men in white robes to worship before the throne as he's doing his work down here. So that dynamic, I think, presses through history. Yeah, Ed.
The siege of Jerusalem, how long did that take place?
That was two parts of it. So I think it started in 66. And then pulled back.
If it fits that timeline, if we take it literally. No.
We don't take things literally around here. But.
Not quite. So much.
Yeah. No, and there's even the persecution of Nero that started in 64. At the end of 64, you know, officially Christianity's outlawed, and Nero's increasingly taking pains to kill Christians. That runs just about 42 months or whatever it is. I mean, it's like a very similar court kind of timing. If you're going to do the 42 month or 1360 days or whatever, literally, it's like right there too. So. Those things kind of vie for literal. You know, it kind of says, maybe that literalism's not so bad. So, anyway, there are those things. Okay, let's get back to this because we're not going to get anywhere near the end of it if we're not moving. Okay, so the rapture is the catching up of believers. And the question about the rapture, we'll get the rapture first. The rapture comes from the Thessalonians text where God, we're going to be caught up and meet Jesus in the air. Anyone want to read that first? I got it here. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, and you can see it. And now, this has been in the Bible since there's been a Bible. Okay, so people read this. Sometimes, the reason I mention that is because sometimes people read this and say, how could you not believe in a rapture in like modern rapture theory? I'm like, well, the whole church has read this for centuries and not come up with the modern rapture theory until the modern church. So you can't, can't blame us. But let's read this one, because it's definitely an encouraging passage, which is the point. Again, verse 17, right at the end there. I'll start at verse 13, just read this section. But we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep, that is, the brothers who have died, that you may not grieve as others who have no hope. For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep. That means the dead saints are with Christ, and when he returns, they're coming with him. Yeah, that's what that's doing. For this we declare to you by a word from the Lord, that we who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will not precede, he used to say prevent in King James, those who have fallen asleep. We're not going to go ahead of them. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry, with the cry of command, sounds pretty loud, with the voice of an archangel, also loud, and with the sound of the trumpet of God, that seems loud too. The reason I say it's loud, because dispensationalists read this as the secret rapture. Right? This is secret. No one knows. If this car is unmanned, right? That's what's going on. What's going on? Well, I guess they didn't hear the cry, the call, and the trumpet. Anyway, the dead in Christ will rise first. Okay, so the ones who have already gone to be with the Lord, their bodies are coming up before anything happens to the rest of us who are alive. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together, there's your rapture, with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will always be with the Lord. And importantly, therefore, encourage one another with these words. The whole point of eschatology is encouragement of Christians to serve, maybe hastening the day of the Lord. So the idea of being caught up in the air is a question, right? So everyone agrees that the bodies, anybody who believes this, the bodies of the saints that have passed are going to come up from the graves, and they're going to meet with their spirits in the air with the Lord, and we're going to be changed, like Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 15, and meet the Lord in the air. We're all going to be up there. Then the question is, what happens? Okay, now Paul just says, we'll forever be with the Lord. He just kind of like rounds it out. But the dispensationalists for sure have a lot more to say. Hang on. We have many books of things that are going to happen in between of us being caught up in the air and forever being with the Lord, beginning with, anyway, and then going from there. So there's a lot of stuff. Do we continue with Christ back up into the heavenlies at that point? Do we enjoy a wedding feast of the Lamb while there's 7 years of tribulation going on the earth? Okay, all that's premillennial dispensational thought. And then we return with Christ again for yet another resurrection, because this will be the second one. And that's done the one before the millennium. And then there's another resurrection after the millennium per dispensational theory. That's three specific resurrections over the course of 1,007 years. Okay, that's the dispensational plan. I reject all of that. I don't think that's true. I think it's silly. And I think the church hasn't spotted it because it's not there in the Bible. I think that modern folks have kind of made this up. And it's not there's nothing there in the Bible that would suggest it. It's just how they read it and how they construe it is wrong. So the idea here then with the rapture is the people of God, particularly the Christians, because in dispensational thought there are two peoples of God. You're aware of that, right? The earthly people of God, the Jews, Israel, and the heavenly spiritual people of God, the Christians, and the two are different peoples. That's a dispensational distinctive. A distinctive, okay? That's something that they believe and other varieties of Christians do not, and that's probably their deepest mistake. Okay, so the question here with the rapture is, what happens when we get caught up with Jesus near? Do we go into heaven with him while stuff goes on here on earth? Or do we make a U-turn and come back down with Jesus to the earth, and he does what he does here on earth, whether setting up a millennial reign for a more reasonable premillennial position, or raising the dead and judging the nations and bringing in the final stages of the kingdom, right, as per like an all-millennial and post-millennial theory. Okay. Now, there's a debate among premillennialists that generates books like this. It's like three views on the rapture. So is the church going to be raptured before the Great Tribulation? Be out of it and not experience tribulation? That's called pre-tribulational rapture, pre-trib. And at the bottom there is defined. Or is it going to happen in the middle, 3.5 years in, halfway through the tribulation, there's the rapture, and then the last 3.5 years are in different places, which is kind of the weirdest one to me. And then the post-tribulational theory is the church will actually go through the Great Tribulation, and then Jesus will come after it, which to me seems like the most sensible of all of them, the most biblical, as I understand it. So, we can read those definitions. The rapture will occur before the Great Tribulation. That's pre-tribulational rapture. Mid-trib, 3.5 years in, and post-trib, after. And we'll endure through tribulation. I put that in quotes because of the changing of the hymn. That may thy people escape tribulation. I'm trying to think of the song. Anyone remember the hymn? They open the life gate. I can't remember. But anyway, it's been changed. It's been modified to endure through tribulation. Not expecting a pre-tribulational rapture, but a post-trib rapture where the church has to go through the Great Tribulation. So, question? Yes?
So, I have two parts. And one historic premill would be post-tribulation.
Generally, yes.
And amillennial would be post-tribulation.
Yeah, they're big into tribulation, those amills. Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Those amills are big into tribulation. Yeah, so I think majority report among Christians historically would be post-tribulation position. And premillennialists have, people that are divided over this and kind of fighting over the tribulation. The rest of us say, well, post-trib makes sense. Let's move on. It's a little simpler. So it's nice not to be a premillennial sometimes. It's just easier. It really is. The diagrams and the charts aren't anywhere near as impressive, but that's just, you know, what we have to suffer. Other questions? Yeah, the two-part question? The all-mills premium? Okay. Okay, yes, sir.
Is this tribulation, is it quantified, such as maybe the warning to get out of Jerusalem before the destruction, and that warning is what word is you're using in Scripture? Is there a quantifying? Is there a way to... How do I know what it is?
Right.
What is it? Well, or do I take world events and fit them into that word? I take Scripture word and try to identify what it is.
Maybe I'll kind of take a roundabout quick answer. Is the word tribulation is used of Christians in all sorts of contexts, right? But there is the Great Tribulation, which, you know, Great Tribulation, same word, but great in front of it, that Jesus appears to be talking about in all the discourse, this terrible time of judgment coming. And then Revelation talks about the same thing, the Great Tribulation and saints being brought into the heavenlies out of their deaths in the Great Tribulation, which would include, I guess, you know, that the church is there. So much for pre-tribulation rapture, thinking of that anyway, right? Because they're coming out of the tribulation. So it makes it hard for pre-tribulation there. But the idea then is Christians are going to deal with in all ages tribulation. We have three sworn enemies, and that's not going to stop, and sometimes it's going to get bad for us. But there's a focused time of this, you know, in the preterist sense in that first century in 70, or in a futurist sense of you know, it's going to happen, and when it happens, it'll start happening. Then it'll be the Great Tribulation, and maybe we'll be raptured out before it or not. So there's a commonality to tribulation through the church. But it seems that there is a specific thing, whether quantifiable or not, of the Great Tribulation, a period of intense tribulation. So, does that get at your...
Well, it just seems kind of odd that there's that level versus many scriptures that talk about you will have trouble in this life.
You bet.
And expect to be persecuted. Mm-hmm. Bear the cross and many other, multiple scriptures. And to think that, I'm going to escape something... That you know, it's my view or somebody's view that there's a bad time coming. I don't get it. I don't see what other than how you whatever the Great Tribulation is.
Right.
Is kind of minimalistic.
Yeah. Well, we should definitely expect tribulation as Christians. Right?
I can speak to the dispensational view on that. Not that I hold it, but how they formulate that is that they see the Great Tribulation as the wrath of God, and we're told as believers that we're not under the wrath of God or will experience the wrath of God, so therefore they think we have to not be present.
Right. Again, there are people being killed in the middle of this thing that are going to heaven, so they're obviously not escaping it exactly.
Right.
Now, they're escaping the wrath of God and that kind of other, but to me it's like a switch of sense. Like, there's a historical reality going on, and Christians are caught in the middle of it. By faith, they're saved, but they still go through the tribulation, right? They still go through the struggle.
They're not experiencing the wrath of God, but they're experiencing
the salvation of God in a very uncomfortable way. Right.
Does whatever Greek word for rapture, whatever that word is, does it have, like, an escape sense built into it, or does it just mean caught up? Because in the Thessalonian thing, right after that, rapture or whatever, we're with Christ who's coming in the clouds, right? Which is like you taught us from Psalm 110 or whatever, means he's coming in judgment. I mean, coming in the clouds has a sense of like
absolutely
foreboding judgment.
Yeah.
So it would seem like maybe that's the escape from...
Yeah, I think the word caught up is pretty simple in the sense of just caught up. And the word rapture, it doesn't come from the Greek word at all. It comes from the Latin later on, rapio. So we get the word rapture from that. So you might say, the word rapture isn't even in the Bible. Something like that. But that's not helpful. What is there is being caught up in the air. And then the question mark, and we'll end here, is, well, what happens then? We all agree we're going to caught up in the air with Christ. Does he do a U-turn and we take us to heaven and stuff happens down here? Or do we do the U-turn and we come back down to the earth and welcome the Lord in, which makes the most sense. And then when he comes, he does his thing. Whether it's setting up a thousand-year kingdom or whether it's judging and ushering in the final part of the kingdom, which is, I think, what's going to happen there. Yes, Bruce.
So how do we know when the great tribulation starts if we believe the rapture occurs at the end?
So we know it starts by the signs that Jesus says. Jesus says, hey, there's going to be wars and rumors of wars, but these are proximate signs. It doesn't start yet. Right? So we read Matthew 24, and if you're reading like a futurist, you're going to be looking for those signs in the future.
But we have that now.
What's that?
We have all those now.
We have them all now. But like, but they had them, and they had been, I mean, there have been wars, rumors of wars all through ministry, right? So, but that's, Jesus says, these aren't the signs yet, right? When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, now you know that it's going down. And his disciples who heard him say that with their very eyes saw Jerusalem surrounded by armies, and it went down, right? So, to me, the whole thing just is so easily understood in the preteristic sense in that first century that he's talking to those guys and they're going to deal with it, not telling us what's going to happen in 3,000 years because that wasn't even what they were talking about. They're talking about this temple and the stones of this temple and aren't they really cool, Jesus, and all that, right? So the whole thing to me is tied back in that preteristic sense, which makes a great deal of sense but isn't without problems, right? None of these positions are without difficulties, right? And hard to understand parts of the text. Did that kind of answer your question? So a futurist is looking for Jerusalem, rebuilt temple, maybe, surrounded by armies for certain, right? All those things they're going to try to see in the future or when they happen presently or something like that, you know, to the people who are there. Was there one more? Yeah, Kim, last one.
So you think there's more than one day of the Lord, is that?
Sure, well, there have been days of the Lord all through redemptive history, as far as days of judgment upon, you know, this or that group of people.
So when it says day of the Lord,
maybe not.
Thank you.
No, maybe not. Though I think that when that will be the day of the Lord in the most absolute sense when it comes, but there are days of visitation of wrath. Other than
I kind of remember back you were talking about it coming as a thief in the night, right? Mm-hmm. You said that was all they were looking for it right then. But in that passage, it says he's still talking about the day of the Lord coming like a thief in the night. He's using the same language, but.
It could be. It ought to be a little confusing because I'm teaching it, and I don't have it all pulled together. You know, so I give you the best I got, and that's the end of it. So let's pray.